Now time for us to catch up on stories making headlines across the world on this week's World Report with Justin McCarthy.
Good morning. On today's programme, why Irish ski instructors are in demand in Switzerland and how the residents of some of Spain's holiday islands want to ban foreigners from buying up property. But first we go to Canada, where health experts would like dry January to be extended all year round. A government-backed report advises that zero alcohol is the only risk-free approach if you want to avoid cancers and heart diseases. But it says if you must drink at all, two drinks maximum each week is really all anyone should be having to keep health risks low. The advice has come as a shock to many Canadians who'd previously been told that up to 15 drinks a week was low risk. From Canada, Dan Karpinchuk reports.
The Centre on Substance Use would like, ideally, for Canadians to cut alcohol consumption altogether. The federal government paid for the study, and it's clear there is an effort to change people's behavior as far as drinking is concerned. It's likely no surprise the release of the guidelines came so close to the Christmas holidays, when get-togethers with family and friends usually involve alcohol, and often a bottle of wine or spirit would be seen by many as an appropriate Christmas gift. But some experts say the new guidance could lead to people having some frank conversations with their doctors, and perhaps that could lead them to make more informed choices. Others are horrified at the advice to imbibe no more than two drinks a week, and many will ignore the guidelines altogether. But the Canadian Centre on Substance Use and Addiction said recently that no amount of alcohol is safe, suggesting that people who consume one or two drinks a week face low health risks. It says that level increases to a moderate risk for 3 to 6 drinks a week, and any more than that, the risk becomes high. The centre updated its previous guidelines, written in 2011. At the time, it said 15 drinks a week for men and 10 for women was considered low risk. It says the new recommendations are based on the latest research into the risks of cancers, including breast and colon, as well as risks of injuries, accidents, and violence, not to mention heart disease. The new guidelines are stricter than in other countries, including France, Britain, and Australia. Compared with Canada, the guidelines in Australia suggest 10 drinks a week represent low health risks. But some experts say standard drinks in Canada are about a third stronger because the ethanol content is higher. The CCSA also wants governments to mandate warning labels on alcohol bottles and cans so people understand how many standard drinks they contain and the health risks involved, as well as guidance on consumption, in much the same way as warnings on cigarette packages. The guidance is also based on the findings of a panel of 23 experts who reviewed nearly 6,000 studies over 2 years and included public consultations nearly 2 years ago. Some experts say getting people to change may be a tough job without a broader debate about the evidence that justified the new consumption guidelines. Heidi Tworek is an associate professor of public policy at the University of British Columbia. She says that kind of conversation about science communication in general has been difficult. She suggests it will take time and different types of communication before the message is able to reach people enough for them to consider a change. It also requires federal and provincial governments to take part through education campaigns and public health policies. Dr. Peter Butt co-chaired the CCSA's guidelines project. He says, "We're not promoting abstinence, but trying to encourage Canadians to become better educated about alcohol, and to reflect on their usage and to understand the risks and harms and make informed decisions." Butt refers to the World Health Organization's recent statement that there is no safe level of consumption. But will Canadians care? Some say they are rethinking their alcohol consumption, and others say they might respond to warning labels on alcohol containers. After all, they say, if alcohol could destroy your liver, shouldn't there be a warning? Warning labels may also have more of an impact on younger drinkers who aren't so set in their ways when it comes to how much they drink. Not everyone, however, agrees with the guidelines. Dan Malik is a medical historian on alcohol policy at Ontario's Brock University. He calls the guidance fear-mongering, adding that it ignores the social benefits of people gathering for drinks. He says he sees in the guidelines the language of temperance or moral judgment, which he believes is a problem, and that the CCSA could discredit itself by going too far. The alcohol industry is also pushing back, saying they voluntarily inform people to drink responsibly, so there's no need for any warning labels. However, the voluntary warnings don't include the serious health risks, including cancer. Getting provincial governments on board may also be a long process. Ontario, for example, through its Liquor Control Board, has hundreds of locations across the province where it sells beer, wine, and spirits to the public. With sales of more than $7 billion a year in 2021 and a net profit of more than $2.5 billion. For World Report, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
To Switzerland next, where Irish qualified ski instructors are growing in number. In the post-Brexit era, Irish ski schools are becoming increasingly popular among would-be instructors who want to be qualified within the EU. From Verbier in Switzerland, Connor Power reports.
Although Switzerland is not in the EU, in many ways it behaves just like it is. The Swiss have long-standing relationships with their neighbours, particularly with the French, with whom they have a shared travel zone for many decades, similar to the one that we have with the UK. More recently, Switzerland has become part of the Schengen Free Travel Area, so that visitors from all their neighbouring countries, and from many beyond, move freely across its borders. Switzerland has a number of well-known and highly frequented ski resorts. Verbier, in the canton of Le Valais, in the southwest of the country, is one of the best known, and it is currently ranked as the best ski resort in the world, a title it has retained for the second year running. Arriving in Verbier in January, one of the first things you'll notice about this chocolate box character town is the large number of British visitors. Many of them live here permanently, and there are a number of ski schools catering for English-speaking tourists, as well as training them to become ski instructors. But since Britain's somewhat chaotic, slow exit from the EU, Britons have found many of the same problems with working and living in Switzerland that they found in the EU. Work permits and entitlements to live in the country, specifically. But it's an ill wind that doesn't blow some good, and in Verbier, Irish passports and Irish ski qualifications have recently become highly sought after currency. Amongst some of the British residents in the town, I came across a number of people who had made use of their Irish ancestry to make life easier for them by claiming the Irish passport that they're entitled to. Steve and Annie, originally from Brighton in the south of England, for example, are a couple who have been coming to Verbier for decades, and have, since the last 2 years, moved into the area permanently. Something made possible by Steve's Irish parentage. Similarly, Will, a ski instructor from London, has also made use of his Irish heritage to get himself a much coveted EU passport. But it's a Verbier-based ski school, the only one offering an Irish ski instructor qualification, that has been the most surprising benefactor of the new order created by Brexit. Warren Smith is an English-born Irishman of Monaghan extraction who has been teaching people to ski and snowboard since he set up his ski academy in Verbier in 1998. He is also a professional skier with the Fulkill International Free Ski Team since 2002. The many clients who have passed through his hands include members of British royalty as well as a number of well-known British celebrities. And many Irish celebrities too, including Brian McFadden, Vogue Williams and Ronan and Storm Keating. Over the years, he said, we've found that the Swiss have been incredibly receptive of the Irish qualification, which is fantastic, really. It's one of the reasons why it makes sense having an EU instructor's qualification. It's proved itself to be a very valuable tool. Back in the day, people wouldn't even have thought to use an Irish qualification, but now that the political situation has changed, it's become an extremely valuable qualification. When Brexit happened, he said, membership of the IASI, or the Irish Association of Snowboarders Instructors, which despite its name is mainly geared towards skiing, went through the roof. A lot of people jumped ship from the British qualification to the Irish one. There used to be a couple of hundred of us, says Warren. Now it's in the thousands. He adds that one of the people who should be credited with this success is Pete Silver Gillespie, another second-generation Irishman based at the Hemel Hempstead Snow Centre, 40 kilometres northwest of London, UK's largest indoor ski slope. Warren describes it as almost a UK base for the IASI. For example, he says, our gap year course has got mainly British people booking onto it, and they're taking an Irish qualification. Whereas years ago, it would have been looked upon as an inferior or even pointless product. We now have one of the busiest ski schools in Verbier, and all of the team are IASI qualified. Now in his early 50s, Warren is still skiing and snowboarding at the highest levels of free skiing, what you might call the sharp end of off-piste skiing. Although he has never represented Ireland in downhill skiing, there's no doubting his immense pride at finding himself at the head of a true Irish skiing revolution in the heart of the Alps. For RTE World Report in Verbier, Switzerland, this is Conor Power.
Finally, we go to Spain, where on the Balearic Islands, officials want to ban non-residents from buying up property, the price of which is escalating out of the reach of local people in Mallorca, Menorca and Ibiza. It's resulted in ghost villages or empty homes owned by foreigners who come to visit the islands once or twice a year, but don't live there all year round. Locals on the Canary Islands are also watching developments closely, with their own interests at heart, as Cliona O'Flynn reports.
If you see the Irish Taoiseach having a quiet coffee with the Balearic Islands Vice President Juan Pedro Llanes, don't be surprised. They both have housing issues top of their problem list. And the Spaniard has already stated how he might solve the island's particular problem. Restrict the sale of residential property to foreigners. Already this year, Canada has introduced a new law that bans non-citizens, non-permanent residents and foreign corporations from buying homes in the country to combat what is seen as rampant estate speculation that's driving up house prices for ordinary Canadians. Sound familiar? The problem is it's very much reflected too in parts of Spain. In essence, officials on Spain's Balearic Islands want to restrict non-residents from buying property as soaring prices in Mallorca, Menorca and Ibiza drive local people out and create ghost villages of empty homes for much of the year. And how such legislation might work would be watched closely by other parts of Spain, especially in other islands like the Canaries. In these small islands, space is quite simply limited and at a premium in the holiday destinations. Many workers who are needed to keep the tourists and those self-same foreign residents fed and watered have to travel long distances to get to and from work as they simply cannot afford to buy or rent in the holiday spots. Francina Armengol, the president of the Balearic Islands, has pointed out that many Europeans and other citizens can afford property at prices that are impossible for the residents of these islands. According to the Spanish Registration Office, about 60,000 foreigners have bought homes in the islands in the last 10 years. And in 2021, the percentage of home purchased by foreigners in the Balearics was 40%, with only the Canary Islands coming close to similar foreign resident purchase at just under 26%. In Spain overall, the rise in interest from overseas buyers has increased too, with Irish buyers in the top five on that list, behind the Netherlands and Germany, followed by Scandinavian countries and the USA. The battle for homes among foreigners versus Spaniards is exceptionally strong, with economists citing this as a primary reason for the huge rise in home prices on the islands. The village of Deia in western Mallorca is an example. Long a favourite among the Brits since the poet Robert Graves made his home there in the late 1920s, property sells there now for just over 6,000 euros per square metre, the second most expensive in Spain. Estate agents Engel and Völkers have, for instance, a two-bedroom house in the village for sale at 1.6 million euros. However, Hans Lentz, the director of Engel and Völkers, says that to praise actions like that of Canada, the effects of which have not been analysed, is very risky. He adds that aggressive interventions in the housing market elsewhere have had serious legal consequences, and that experts have warned that limiting purchases to foreigners will not generate more housing for the resident population. But some might argue that he has a vested interest. In that same village, 37% of all properties are foreign-owned. And as local residents are driven out and homes are left empty for much of the year, there is less custom for bars and restaurants, and businesses struggle to attract staff because rents are too high. In other islands around Spain, similar problems are growing, with the local wages unable to compete with foreign wealth when it comes to buying or renting property anywhere in a resort area. Balearic Vice President Illanes says he knows that a ban or restrictions may be seen as contrary to the European principle of free movement, but points out that there are precedents for such a move. In the Austrian Alps, for example, where the EU has recognised areas of cultural significance or natural beauty that should be protected from excessive outside pressure. Another precedent is in the Åland Islands in Finland, where there are limits on buying second homes. In Croatia, EU citizens must be residents for 10 years before they can buy agricultural land. and the Faroe Islands, part of Denmark, have also moved to restrict foreign purchases of properties. There are varying views among local non-Spanish residents in the Balearic Islands. One said he thought that what the government is forgetting is that in Mallorca, for instance, many of the properties were built for the tourist market and that sadly, without tourism, there isn't much of an economy. Libby Warren, a long-time resident and worker in Ibiza, was more supportive of the move. She told me that rents and prices have jumped up in recent years and there needs to be some controls. She is British, but hoping to buy soon and having legally lived in the Balearics for over 5 years, she would be entitled to. Either way, with tourism in the Spanish islands experiencing a post-pandemic boom, this is a problem that won't go away. And how the EU will react to any property restrictions will be of interest to places well beyond the Balearic Islands. For World Report, this is Cliona O'Flynn in Spain.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back to the programme, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.